everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science, Facts, and Fallacies Podcast. My name is Cameron English, your host as always. We got the band back together, like the Eagles, we're on a greatest hits tour. The man, the myth, the plant geneticist, Dr. Kevin Folta is with us, while Liza is on a world tour spreading the blessings of sustainable agriculture. Kevin, what's up, man? It's been a long time. How are you?
Hey, it feels good to be back in the chair. I really do miss doing this. It's hard for me to not take every opportunity to talk to people about science. And as much as I hated being away, it's always, I really appreciate it. I'm very grateful for the opportunities to come back and do it again. So thank you very, very much.
Yeah, anytime. Standing invitation. Kevin, of course, hosts the Talking Biotech podcast, which I want to say is probably the most popular show in this space, talking about sustainable farming and agriculture, and I guess genetics more broadly these days. But you do that
show.
Yeah,
we go pretty broad.
Yeah. And then you go on other people's shows, you do public speaking, and you're also a full professor. So you're teaching students and doing research, you know, so it's totally understandable that you can't show up every day to make dad jokes with me, or every week, excuse me.
Well, and then nowadays we're doing a lot more on the farm and we're really, really dialing it up and I'm trying to figure out what I want to do 10 years from now, which would be, you know, post-university time, probably. And I think I know what I want to do, but it requires me to do things now. And so if I'm going to set up if you want to do a big U-pick of seasonal produce, you can't say, okay, let's do it this year. You know, you got to set it up well ahead of time. So I'm kind of planting the seeds, so to speak, and grafting the trees and getting things in the ground. So in 2034, we can do something really cool here on the property. So that's, you know, agritourism and getting people excited about picking what can be grown locally and what's exciting and all that, and with a very substantial carbon footprint.
That is awesome. It sounds like a great time. I'll have to make my way down there when that happens. Bring my kids and come see your awesome farm setup. So
yeah, so where are you with the second one?
Second one is 2 months away now. So we're really excited that it's an interesting mix because the other one's almost three at this point. So his world is about to be rocked when when the little one shows up. He's going to be like, hey, what the hell? I didn't sign up for this. I was the special one, you know. So, but everything's good. Everything's good. Thank you for asking. It's always good to talk about my kids. I love doing that. So let's jump into our stories, though, because I feel like you and I could just reminisce for an hour. Just you know, shooting the breeze, whatever. But we're only going to cover two stories this week because I sent Kevin three, and then I forgot that the first one we talked about last week. So my bad. So bonus content. We're going to spend a little extra time talking about these two stories. So the first one is called "Why Is Trust in Scientific Research at an All-Time Low?" And the second story is a classic for us, as fitting for a greatest hits episode. Feeding your child 2,000 nectarines or 340 apples in one day. Environmental Working Group claims about the dangers of conventionally grown produce are scientifically absurd. Very detailed headline there. Okay, so let's get into this first story. This is a really interesting one, Kevin, and given all of the research that you publish and that you help other people publish, I really want to get your take on this. This is by Dr. Henry Miller and S. Stanley Young. Henry, by the way, is at the American Council on Science and Health, where I write, just an FYI. And I love his work. It's really, really good because he deals with these kind of topics. But here he's talking about the fact that an increasing number of studies that are published in peer-reviewed journals, which is, you know, in science is the gold standard. If you can get something peer-reviewed and in a journal for a long history, a long period of history in science, that was an indication that you were doing good work, or at least worthy of discussion work, I should say. But what's happening these days is you're getting more studies published that don't replicate. So you'll have one group of researchers publish a paper, another group comes up behind them, tries to replicate the results, and they can't. That's happening more and more. Of course, you have the phenomenon that we talked about of predatory journals, where people pay a fee, and then they can publish almost anything in these journals. And some of the emails that Kevin's talked about are hilarious because they're so transparently dishonest. But some of them are difficult to decipher because if you go to a website, a journal can look legit. and the content can look legit, and they can post pictures of people and say, here's our editor, Dr. So-and-so from the University of blah, 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 right? And it can be hard to tell. And so the two critical issues that Henry and Stanley bring up is that the body of literature of science that we're producing is useless. That's a real problem, because if we can't, you know, do good science, we can't solve practical problems like feeding people and making airplanes fly and building bridges that stand up and so forth. And then the other thing is trust in science. So if people are constantly reading in the headlines that this study was retracted and this study is a lie, and over time people are going to go, well, I'm just not going to listen to any of this. This is all nonsense. This all the science stuff. So this is a critical issue, and we need to do something. I don't know what the answer is, Kevin. I don't know if anyone knows. But what was your take on this?
Yeah, it's a problem that it really bothers me in a lot of ways. And one reason is, and let me go backwards. Let me take a backward step first, is that I love that these two stories are juxtaposed, because the story talks about the lack of trust in science and how it hurts science. But then you talk about, we'll talk about next, the Environmental Working Group, which is an NGO that publishes or extrapolates from published data, and everybody trusts them. So the bad science is being trusted, the good science is not being trusted. What's going on here? And that's kind of the theme of today's discussion. The thing with this article from Miller and Young is that it discusses the reasons that people lack trust. And there's been a lot of studies on this about the lack of reproducibility between studies. And that's legit. I mean, there are many examples where you can't reproduce work. And we'll talk about why that happens later on. But as somebody who is an editor, who's a reviewer, who's an author, I have never found the peer-reviewed literature to be more rigorous than ever before, at least in terms of the viewpoint of legitimate work. So in other words, if you're going through back channels and you're publishing shoddy work in lousy journals and maybe paying to publish, maybe that's easier than ever. Yet the flip side of that is that the work that is credible, the work that is solid, the work that's, it has never been harder to publish. And as an author, my reviews come back, and if my paper gets accepted with revision, which, you know, happens, I would say I get either major revisions or minor revisions most of the time, it's a set of very thoughtful, critical reviews of people who really thought about things that I failed to think about. And I'm very grateful for that. I love the fact that people help me shape the work for the journal. And an editor says, well, here's what I want you to do. So it's this kind of guidance and partnership that you make as an author with reviewers and an editor to make a journal article appropriate for that journal. And that has never been harder to do. Meaning the bar is high. Publishing good journals is difficult. There's a lot that reviewers want. There's a lot that editors want. So I'll start by saying that. At the same time, there's many opportunities for less than credible research to find a place in the body of peer-reviewed literature. And what that boils down to is predatory publishing, as you mentioned before. The article here mentions that there is a spokesperson from one of the major publishing houses that says that editors are offered cash in return for publishing papers. And I'm an editor for a couple journals, and I wish someone would offer me cash to pick. I'd keep the cash and say, I don't know anything about the article, because that is kind of ethical, right? I mean, if someone's going to try to, you know, because I'm that protective of the peer review literature, you know, I mean, I really feel this is something that's relatively sacred that we should be protecting as best we can. And editors are gatekeepers here, and we need to be doing better. At the same time, predatory publishing is everywhere. There are journals that if you look at their addresses that they send you, they're in a storage locker in a, you know, like a used storage facility in Augusta, Georgia. And the main editor's email address is in Nigeria. So it is an industry now, and it's full of fraud. There's so many places where people can publish something that has the patina of legitimate research. And that is a major, major problem. So that's one side of that. The other side of this is that there is an incentive in some places, namely China, to publish a paper, financial incentive. So they will offer thousands of dollars, or as I understand it, maybe even bonus of a better house or a better place to live or whatever, a better laboratory, whatever, if you get papers published in marquee journals. Mm. And so a lot of data are incentivized, or a lot of papers are incentivized to be published, even if the data are loose or maybe there's some fraud, some fudging of data, whatever. This is something that is real. At the same time, that there are reasons that things are sometimes not reproducible. And I know in my career, I can think of a couple. I know that one time they took a protocol that I published, and this was actually many labs that could not get it to reproduce and couldn't never get it to work. And they would call me on, at the time, on Skype, and they would show me their per-call gradients, and I would say, well, yeah, you're taking the wrong layer. And then they would take it, and then they could get it to reproduce, but once they were able to sort out some esoteric technical difficulties. But this is someone who reached out and was able to make it work. Another time, a guy came to my lab, and we did it together. And he sent me seeds a week ahead of time. We did the protocol together. We worked nights. We stayed up all night working on it. We were able to do 3 replicates in a week where he couldn't get a single replicate to work on his own back in his lab in Arkansas. So there are reasons that, technical reasons and small little bits that make protocols that are so complicated not necessarily easy to reproduce. So that's another reason. The other one I even in my lab, if I'm not being boring, my first lab I was in, I developed a protocol for strawberry transformation that when they moved my lab to the new shiny new one, didn't work. So I moved upstairs and it couldn't get it to fly. But a lab in Washington State University was able to use it perfectly. Mm. So there's something about, the water, the whatever, there's little differences that make these things challenging. So yes, there is fraud. Yes, there are problems. There's issues with p-hacking where people will do post-hoc analysis, meaning after their data are in, they'll keep fitting statistical models or statistical tests until they find something significant, which is not the way it works. I had a student try that once, and I did it. Nope, don't work that way. but these are all inroads to how people are able to develop literature that, or papers or data that they try to get published in marquee journals or in any journal and are hard to reproduce.
I love the idea of you taking the money from fraudsters and then like buying microscopes with it. I think that's hilarious. And it's sort of like, someone steals a pack of gum off the shelf and then you trip them on their way out the door. It's like,
Oh, it's like the guy sawing your catalytic converter off and you steal his Sawzall, You're actually kind of doing the world a favor by cleansing the marketplace of this kind of activity. Yeah. And I say that kind of jokingly because, it's something that never has happened to me, but I'm sure it happens. There are, when you are in an academic position these days with tenure and then now in many states losing the tenure system, you have to remain productive to keep your freaking health insurance. And maybe we'll just kind of, include these data, not these data. There's a weird incentive to do that because you're fighting for your life and your family and your safety and your security. And all of these things together are very strong forces to compel you to maybe not play by the rules. Mm-hmm. And so it takes, you got to have a real strong ethical backbone and a very strong sense that even if you get fired for telling the truth about data, don't get me started on that, that you'll have a good landing spot. That's why most people, play by the rules. Mm-hmm. In a world that is now where politicians are now deciding whose science is good and whose isn't. It's a very different landscape.
Yeah, there's lots of undue influences, I guess we could say, on the way that science is done. In the way of solutions, what do we do? I mean, I've heard people say, you know, we need journals that will openly accept null results, because that way, if you put all this time and money into a paper, I think they call it the desk drawer phenomenon or whatever, where like you do it, especially in clinical research, you'll do a study and you won't get the result. And you go, just throw it in the file, you know, no good doing that. But one of the things I've heard is that, well, it would be useful if you publish that in a journal, and then you could say, here's what we do, what we did, don't do it, because it didn't work, you know? So there's some value in that. Obviously, it's not the next blockbuster drug or whatever, but that seems like one practical solution that would help. What do you think? And is there anything better than that?
Well, think of all the careers of people who've gone out to show that, you know, that glyphosate causes cancer, you know, and they took postdocs in laboratories to try to test that hypothesis that came out as no, and that doesn't get published anywhere. And so not only does it not build their CV and their research evidence for good work they did, it also doesn't get out to the public that here's some data that are contradictory to the, you know, the claims that we see in courts. So yeah, there's a great idea, there's a great impetus to publish negative data. I think it's a wonderful idea because it would save a lot of time and money from people going down the wrong alleys to find out that they're blind again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good point. One other thing that I've heard is possibly, I guess there's a bunch of things, but one thing is paying editors or paying reviewers, which is all done. Maybe you can speak to that too, because you don't get paid for being a reviewer at a journal. And I think editorial positions are paid for most of them. But the people, oh no? Okay. So in other words, this is an important point then, because the people overseeing the publication of a lot of this stuff are not paid to, and I mean not to impugn their integrity. I'm sure a lot of people mean well, and they do work hard to make sure they're not letting bunk into the journals. But if you are paid to do something, I think everybody recognizes very clearly that incentivizes you to take the work more seriously. Do you think that would be helpful?
I kind of agree with that. Maybe not. That the big journals like Science and Nature have professional editors that they hire to do that editorial work. In most other journals, it's volunteer. And in the journals in our disciplines, it's volunteer work. I don't get paid a penny to do the work that I do. And it's a lot of work. And these days, as an editor, to find two reviewers for a paper, I may have to solicit 30 different scientists to find two reviewers, because everybody's busy and everyone declines. And now when we're in a publish or perish environment more than ever before, why should you be reviewing a paper, which takes 4 to 6 hours to do right, when you should be writing your paper? And this is where we are now. And so the model is in a perilous situation, that you end up getting reviewers who agree to do the work that submit a two-sentence review that isn't helpful for you as an editor or to the reviewer itself or to the author themselves. And then you get other reviewers who are highly defensive, who can think of every other experiment that you could have done, and forget that the idea of the reviewer is not to trash the work, but to say, here's how it fits the scope and depth of this journal. Here's how your paper can be revised or how it does or doesn't fit. That's the job of the reviewer. It's really hard to get reviewers. And so all of the extra burdens that we have as researchers, where we used to, you know, do research and see what oozed out of the test tube, review a paper a month. Now it's a question of, you know, we're on committees, we're on all these other committees, we're teaching more, we're filling in gaps, we're doing all these other jobs. Reviewing a paper, I mean, I've never turned down, I turn down at least one or two a day. And the ones that I take, I'm very selective. And it's really unfortunate, because that's the backbone of this concept of peer review, is having someone to review. So it is something that's in a very perilous state, and maybe paying reviewers would be a little bit helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, go check out this article. There's lots of good stuff in here. They get into some practical things that I don't think a lot of people realize. Like, you know, a lot of researchers have a limited understanding of statistics. So they might not intentionally, but they might misinterpret their results. You know, things like that happen, or like Kevin was saying, sometimes it's so technical to reproduce an experiment that, you know, so there are practical things as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, throw one thing on exactly on that is that I've had mountains of statistics, but when I see a paper where they say, oh, we did a 2-4 Remulin transformation followed by a Albertson Walker goodness of fit test. It's like, I don't know what the hell those things are. And now I got to go do a whole statistics class to try to figure out why they're using this kind of massaging of data. And was this in their pre-hoc analysis? Right. Or did they do the experiment, show it wasn't significant, and then have to resort to some oddball statistical test to try to find a way to show that it's significant? Mm-hmm. That's p-hacking 101. And I believe that's rampant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so funny, because as a writer and a journalist, you know, I'll read a paper and they're like, we did a Cox hazard ratio, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what in the actual hell? You know what I mean? So yeah. You have to go and check what's, in my case, it's like I'll reach out to someone who reads this stuff for a living. I'll go, please, you know, make me understand or help me understand.
No, we did the Kolmogorov-Smirnov goodness of test for kurtosis. Yeah, you start to wonder what the hell. It takes years. Statistics is a whole discipline unto itself, and so to get a statistical person on your team who's good at, and in some disciplines it's completely acceptable, by the way, to post hoc retrofit the data, but then just report how you got significance.
Right.
Like in I think in finance and other, you know, in business. Figures, you can find ways to monkey wrench the data in ways that massage it in ways to make it fit your hypothesis. But then as long as you report with these tests it failed and with these ones it was good, and now I think a little bit of that bleeds into the physical natural sciences where really it shouldn't be there.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point too. Okay, so let's move on. And this is a related topic, as you alluded to. You know, it's not just that people publish garbage in journals, which happens a lot. Our lawyer friends do that a lot. But in these cases, you have groups like Environmental Working Group or NRDC. They don't even bother going to a journal. They just do some silly test, and then they exaggerate the significance of it, and then they put out a press release. And then they go on Good Morning America, and then all of a sudden, moms across the country are afraid of baby food. You know, So this is the annual thing. They put out the shopping guide, and I don't know if this is separate from the Dirty Dozen, Kevin, or if this is a complimentary effort. But in any case, they put out the shopping guide, and they say these foods or these pieces of produce have these particular pesticides. Now, critically, they never report the dose or however, like the amount you're likely to be exposed to if you eat a pear or an apple or whatever, because they don't want you to know. They just want you to be scared that you could be in harm's way. And that's really the problem. And then the media, probably unwittingly, because they're trying to get eyeballs on their papers, they help. And they say, study shows, you know, blah, 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 insecticide on your kids, you know, apple slices. And then here we are every time this year. So what do you make of this?
Yeah, it's the same old story of the dose makes the poison, right? Here we are sitting at a time where you've got food producers who are claiming, you know, onerous regulation and too much oversight, that we're playing by the rules. Let's not worry about it. You're seeing USDA test raw commodities, fruits and vegetables, and seeing levels of pesticide residues that are far below acceptable limits in almost every case. And yet, folks like the Environmental Working Group are resorting to the old trickery of saying, if the number is not zero, then you're being poisoned. Right? And that's what it is. And so they rely on the fact that with today's modern analytical chemistry, we can detect things that are almost not there. We can detect one part, depends on the compound, but you can detect in the parts per trillion, you can detect in the parts per billion easily. And to put that in context, part per billion is 1 second in 32 years. A part per trillion, 1 second in 32,000 years. So you're looking at a very long timeline in terms of our resolution and be able to see how much is there. The other thing they always leave out is how many samples they tested and how reproducible was that. Mm-hmm. So hearkening back to our previous discussion that, you know, things are never there's reproducibility problem. Somehow that all goes out the window when they test, you know, one box of Kellogg's cornflakes that was bought in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Somehow that reflects all the cornflakes in the world. Yeah. And one sample, you know, which could have had carryover from the previous, or who knows, mm-hmm. a million reasons that can happen. Plus analytical chemistry, there's a lot more to it than I think they're doing maybe some sloppy. Anyway, the bottom line is that the levels that they're reporting to find, it's questionable as to whether or not they're there or not. They find them on organic produce sometimes, and I trust organic growers to not use these things. So I think that's a good negative control. So if you're finding it in organic produce, it means maybe your method is a little sloppy or not quite right with detection. But the other side of this is that the levels are so low that they can't be physiologically relevant. Mm-hmm. And that really, that's the big take-home message. They're not finding anything there, but yet they're scaring people about finding something there.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, I was working on a story for a genetic literacy project, and I contacted Dr. Carl Winter, who was at UC Davis for many years. And he wrote a couple of papers breaking down EWG's methodology, such as it is, to even use that phrase. But he said, you know, here's what they do, and here's what, you know, scientists actually do, right? We actually measure how much is there, and we have thresholds for when we're concerned and when we're not concerned, and there's safety factors between 100 and 1,000 times. And here's how we determine whether farmers are using too much, and here's how we determine if you're exposed to too much. Here's all the regulatory authority that the various agencies have to protect food. And that's another thing that always gets me, Kevin, is like, you know, you'll see a report and they'll say, there's heavy metals in your baby's food, or there's pesticides in your organic Jell-O, or whatever stupid thing it is. Those products can all be recalled if there's a threat. So if the companies think there's a threat, they will pull it off themselves. And if they don't, for whatever reason, the federal government, usually through the FDA or the USDA, can say, this is no longer allowed to be sold because it's potentially hazardous. And almost never is there a recall associated with these shopping guides, because there's no safety risk. And they never explain that to people. And that is enormously frustrating.
You know, that's exactly the point, that they claim that there's the shopping guide with, you know, they imply some sort of risk from these products. But what producer of anything is going to let a crop leave the field or leave the whatever, the factory, with any levels that would be potentially even approaching risk? I mean, you've seen, going back to Roundup, you've seen a company that's one of the largest companies in the world of pharmaceuticals and agricultural products being brought to its knees by endless litigation about a product that has no evidence of causing cancer, mm-hmm. yet lawsuits going for billions and billions of dollars mm-hmm. settled because of an alleged contribution to cancer. So the facts don't matter. Mm-hmm. And that's what EWG relies on. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter that it's a residue. What it is that we detected it, and we think, by our analysis, mm-hmm. that you and your family are at risk. And that's all they need to say. And that's what's so funny about this, especially juxtaposed to the earlier story. For some reason, people trust these data, which are based on a very small sample number and not statistically tested, yet claim that the broader set of science is not reliable because of its lack of reproducibility. Mm-hmm. It's weird what we choose to trust.
Yeah, well, and that reminds me of a really good point, I think. And it has to do with how activist groups like EWG, and this is more prominent in the anti-vaccine movement, where they will rely on results like this. And the most famous example is John Ioannidis, who put out that paper in 2005 that said everything causes and prevents cancer, which was a helpful exercise. I know he's not the most, you know, beloved figure these days, but research like that is helpful for understanding that there may be some blind spots in the literature. But nevertheless, people that are on the activist side, they will look at a study like that and they will go, you know, the whole thing is just, it's all corrupt. It's all rotten to the core. So you have to trust us because we're looking out for your best interests. Also by our partners, organic, you know, baby food.
Right.
But that's an important point to keep in mind. One other thing I wanted to get your take on this is that what these groups will do is they will invent their own standards for it's yes. not even a risk. It's a hazard. They will say, you know, there's a pending piece of legislation in Congress that would lower the acceptable amount of such and such chemical on your food. And it's being stalled because, you know, those big ad guys, they run Congress and they run the EPA and they run everything, right? They're right. They're basically Darth Vader, I guess. But in other words, they take a standard that is not legally relevant and that is unscientific, but because it's before Congress, they go, look, our health experts want this and Congress won't give you this. And that's how you know, right? It's like, it's argument by implication. It's very disingenuous.
Yeah, they did that with glyphosate again. They took the US EPA standard or FDA standard, whatever it was, and then they looked at the California residue standard, and then they made up their own that was like 1/10 of the California mm-hmm. regular, or 1/100. So they make up their own thresholds and then say they're dangerously over the threshold that they made up. And it's fun if you go back and extrapolate and you look at their thresholds, they're all you can take the amounts that are in the product, like let's just say cornflakes or fruity pebbles or whatever. And then if you multiply their numbers, you get exactly what would be their threshold, their danger threshold. Right. So it's all kind of cooked. And, but you know, I really think it's interesting how people trust these activist groups. And the Dirty Dozen will be on CNN and everything else. But legitimate science is looked at next story. Maybe we have to re-question our trust in vaccination, you know. Yeah. So it's a really strange state of things. And I think something that I really want to investigate more.
Yes. Well, if you want to find out more about what Kevin does and interact with him and benefit from his science communication, you can follow him on X or Twitter, what Twix, whatever you want. I don't like calling it X. It's just kind of a stupid name, you know. It's like, it's Twitter.
Yeah.
It's whatever you want to call that platform. Kevin is on it. I think it's just at Kevin Folt, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah, that's right. I like Twix. And can I give a recommendation for Facebook? Okay. I found the best website ever. If you go to, and you love this, I hope everyone does it, and be nice, because they don't kick you off for a while. Bioengineered Processed Foods, Awareness and Alternatives. It is a combination of hilarious and sad. The sad being that these are people who are concerned about their health, who have forever been misguided and lied to by bad people, and who are, I can't go to the grocery store and buy anything anymore. Or I can't afford to eat anything anymore.
Yeah.
Or I want to feed this stuff to my kids, but there's no way I can afford it. It is an unbelievable tome as to the success of the anti-GMO movement in scaring the pants off of people who can least afford to have their pants scared off. Mm-hmm. And I hope you check it out. Bioengineered Processed Foods, Awareness and Alternatives over on Facebook. And don't say Folta sent me.
Yeah. Do not use coupon code Folta when you check out this.
No, I haven't been kicked off yet. Yeah. So, and I've been really nice. And I've been just like, I've been polluting their, I've been pooping in their punch bowl with turds of facts and just being kind about it. And so far, so good. So go over there and change hearts and minds by being gentle and maybe helping some of these poor folks who are, who have been deceived, find a little bit of a comfort in enjoying the world's healthiest food supply.
Yeah, what an image. Keep your pants on if you go over there. Kevin's just but that's really good because, you know, as unsexy as it is, it's the best thing you can do, which is just interact with people where they're getting this information from, and you can neutralize it in some cases, or you can at least plant a seed. And then people now are walking around with this goofy idea, but they're like, oh, this guy also told me that was stupid, you know. Cognitive dissonance. It's a good thing in this case. So,
Well, you can never change someone's mind, but you can help them change their own mind. And please, 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 you know, interact kindly. And you know, this page is loaded with people who have just been wrecked by false information. And let's see if we can save a few souls.
There you go. There you go. Really good advice, as always, from the SciComm master himself, Dr. Kevin Folta. So it's at Kevin Folta on Twitter. At Genetic Literacy for Genetic Literacy Project. As I say every week, they make this possible. They let us say what we want, and it's all their content we discuss. I'm also there too, at Cam J English. Follow me, and if you have questions about the show or you want us to talk about certain things, let us know. And Liza, of course, is at Dr. Liza MD on Twitter. So I always get hers mixed up, but I'm pretty sure that's right. So follow all of us. We'd love to interact with you. And as always, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.